Our next case this morning is 13-797, Propak Industries versus Philip Pixley. And I don't know if counsel was in the room when we started this morning, but the Chief Justice is not able to be with us this morning, but she has read the briefs, will view the oral arguments, and will fully participate in the deliberations on this matter. For the appellants, Mr. Denny.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Gregory Denny. I represent Propak Industries out of Toledo in this intentional tort case. Sitting at counsel table with me is Lori Bridge, co-counsel to Propak. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The case that comes before you today is a significant case. And it's significant because of what the Court of Appeals has done with regard to the application of subsection C under 2745-01. The Court of Appeals decision seriously undermines the intent of the General Assembly in passing 2745-01, and it does it in a couple of ways. First, the Court of Appeals chose not to follow the definition of equipment safety guard as held and pronounced by this court in the Hewitt decision, limiting those class of cases to operators rather than all employees. And perhaps more importantly, the Court of Appeals has created a burden of proof to establish deliberate removal under subsection C of 2745-01. The facts in this case show no knowledge, no deliberate removal by the employer. And yet the Court of Appeals found that the opinions of two experts were sufficient to establish a deliberate removal on behalf of Propak. As this court knows, the intent of the General Assembly in enacting 2745-01 was to not only restrict, but to significantly restrict employer intentional tort litigation in this state. That decision in that piece of legislation was upheld as constitutional in the companion cases of Stetter and Kaminsky by this court. And this court did hold that the legislature's intent was to restrict in a significant manner employment intentional tort claims.
Mr. Denny, this case was on summary judgment, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And can you specifically tell us what the uncontested facts would show?
The uncontested facts show this. There is no evidence in this file that the safety bumper had ever malfunctioned or not worked prior to the day Mr. Pixley was injured.
Can you talk about what that safety bumper is? Talk about the accident a bit.
If you'd like. The car, it's a transfer car, corrugated box plant in Maumee, Ohio. And it takes product and is operated by an employee. And on each end, it runs along a straight track. On each end of that transfer car, there is a bumper called a safety bumper. And if the car hits a box of material or runs into the wall or strikes an employee in the path that shouldn't have been in the path, the function of the car, if the pressure is enough, the weight is enough to collapse the bumper far enough, the purpose is to stop the car.
Was the bumper in place at the time of the incident?
Bumper was in place at the time of the incident, Your Honor. Yes. Yes.
So it was not removed, it was just not functioning. Is that what I'm given to understand?
According to the experts, their opinion was that it was not functioning.
Was it tested subsequent to the accident?
Twice. Immediately.
What were the results of the testing subsequent to the accident?
There were two tests. Immediately after the accident, on the day of the accident, ProPac tested it, put pressure on the bumper, and the bumper operated properly. It shut the controls off and shut the car off when the pressure was applied to the bumper. The next morning, an OSHA investigator came into the plant and took videotapes and ran the transfer car and had and viewed it and also had employees test the safety bumper. There were no citations issued. There were no recommendations issued. These are all undisputed facts in this case. And the OSHA people did recommend, the facts show, well, maybe you ought to put a laser beam on this car for added protection, which ProPac did. Those are the undisputed facts. What the Court of Appeals, what they have done in this case, is they have expanded, rather than restricted, the class of cases that will wind up in the trial courts on intentional employment intentional court cases. And they've done that through their improper interpretation of equipment safety guard in subsection C, and also in establishing a burden of proof on deliberate, where in a case where the employer, there's no evidence the employer did anything to that.
Counsel, if I may, I'm reading from the Court of Appeals opinion, and I'd like to know what you think they're trying to say here. Trial court found that the bumper was not an equipment safety guard because it did not shield the operator.
Correct.
Is that the law in Ohio?
It's the law in Ohio, according to the Hewitt decision.
Why?
This court defined equipment safety guard in Hewitt as a device designed to protect the operator from danger or injury of a dangerous aspect of the machine. That's this court's decision in Hewitt. And it makes sense, if you think about it, we're talking about presuming an employer intended injury here under subsection C.
No, I make no such presumption. I guess where I'm having difficulty is that the trial court was saying, therefore, that since this bumper guard did not injure the operator but someone else, it's not a safety guard.
Yes, Your Honor. That's the decision.
You want us to adopt that?
I think the court has already adopted that in the definition of set forth in Hewitt of equipment safety guard for the protection of the operator.
I understand your argument is that the appellate court erred when it said that their view was the definition of a safety guard should not be limited to operators, but it should be encompassing employees.
All employees, whoever may come
in. What is the errant interpretation there, in your view? Why is that an errant interpretation?
Again,
if, in fact, we have safety guards,
right,
presumably to keep people safe, why wouldn't we want all people to be protected from them as opposed to the operator of the car, for example?
Because we're dealing with a statute with the intent to significantly restrict employer intentional tort litigation. That's the first thing. The employer, let's just take a hypothetical. If an employer removes an equipment safety guard as defined by
this court. I asked you if this was removed and you said it wasn't removed.
In this case, it was not.
So the first question we have to resolve is whether it's a safety guard.
Equipment
safety second
guard.
One is whether it was removed.
Deliberately removed by the employer, right.
And your view is that it's not a safety guard because it wasn't protecting an operator?
My view is it is not a safety guard under the definition of equipment safety guard announced by this court in the Hewitt decision.
Well, but
Are you saying that it was or wasn't removed?
I'm saying the undisputed facts indicate it was not, although there are the opinions of the experts that say it was.
It was what?
It was bypassed. That's what the experts say.
Okay, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt, Justice.
No. That's fine. But Hewitt's fact-specific, there are safety guards that protect not just operators, but other folks. As I recall, one of our other intentional tort cases, the safety device was designed to keep people who are in the aisleways of a warehouse retrieving things from being hit by a tow truck operator, or I don't know, it was a little device that somebody runs up and down the aisles and picks up stuff, and the safety device was designed so that it would stop the thing sort of exactly like what you have here, so that you don't hit somebody that's in the way.
Yes. But the presumption that we're talking about under C is narrowly drawn, and the legislature did not use the word safety device. It used the words equipment safety guard, and those words were defined by this court to effectuate the intent of the General Assembly and to give effect.
But that was a very, I mean, you have to look at these in a very discreet way. And Hewitt was an entirely different kind of fact circumstance from what you've got here.
It was, but the definition of equipment safety guard was what was at issue and what this court struggled with in reaching the meaning of those words. And if those words...
Are we narrowly limited to those words today? Because you're using the word safety guard, and if you just use the English language a little differently, it is a safety device. Let me just suggest, since this went out on summary judgment, and I consider myself a reasonable person, I think we may be disagreeing. You see how much help I get up here. But in this
in this particular case,
the facts are undisputed that there was a safety device designed to keep this machine from injuring people, number one. That's we're not going to waste time on that. But there's also clear evidence that that safety device was not working on the day in question when this person was injured. You can agree with that, can you not? The machine went over the man and was still running until the operator said, whoa.
Well, the facts, I do not believe, substantiate that.
Really?
Right. If you review the...
You mean this safety device was functioning properly that day?
Yes.
Oh, it was?
Yes. Yes.
Is there some evidence, as I read the court, that it deliberately bypassed the proximity switch, thereby allowing the bumper to be compressed without shutting off power to the transfer car?
Those are the opinions of the two mechanical engineers that were retained by plaintiffs. Yes.
How was that accomplished?
How did they reach that conclusion?
Or how was the, let me ask it directly, was the proximity switch bypassed?
No evidence that it was, Your Honor.
Other than the opinion of the two experts.
The somewhat speculation, and I'll call it speculation, of the two experts in this case.
Nonetheless, yes. Two experts testified that in their view that's what occurred, and that was the proximate cause of this injury. Is that the idea?
That's what the experts in their affidavit state. You're right,
okay.
Your Honor.
Mr. Denny.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Mr. Denny, the definition, equipment safety guard, is not defined in statute, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you're saying that it was the Hewitt case that talked about operators, but we did not in Hewitt limit it to operators, did we? I mean, the facts there did not include an employee.
Right. I mean, so, as Justice Pfeiffer said,
I mean,
it's different.
Without doing violence to the statute, in fact, it could be expanded to include not just the operator of the equipment, but anyone who may potentially be injured by the equipment.
It could be. And in that, and if, in fact, that was done, then it would like I say, undermine the entire intent of the General Assembly in restricting this type of litigation, because it would there would be an expansion of intentional tort claims.
And yes. If we were to find that the Court of Appeals was correct in saying that it makes sense to also include employees, because we're talking about the safety, it's safety, an equipment safety guard, so that no one is injured, as the Court of Appeals found, if we were incorrect, the General Assembly could change and redefine equipment safety guard in a different fashion, correct?
They could, but they could, but that would not change the real mischief in this case, and that is the deliberate removal and the lack of any evidence in the record that this employer deliberately removed.
Which is a different story there.
Yeah. I'm well out of time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hewitt. Mr. Flowers.
Good morning, Acting Chief Justice Pfeiffer, members of the court.
No, I'm actually not Acting Chief Justice even. Chief Justice is here in spirit. I'm just the justice.
No offense to the chief.
All right.
My name is Paul Flowers. I represent the plaintiff appellee in this case, Philip Pixie. I'm joined by David Grant, who handled the trial court proceedings and the appeal in the 6th District. I'd like to start with the defense counsel's statement as to what the true intent of the legislature was in this case. Our position is that the intention of the General Assembly must be determined first and foremost from the actual terms used in the statute. And in 2745.01c, the language does not distinguish between operators and non-operators. That's not there. They're trying to work that in through some dicta from the Hewitt case and artificially cut off a number of claims, legitimate claims, that are based upon an employer's deliberate removal of a safety guard. And in their briefs and in their argument, they've never identified one plausible explanation for why the General Assembly would want to make such an odd distinction, one that makes no sense and advances no objectives. It's purely artificial and designed to get them out of liability in this case.
Counsel, would it mean that we'd have to look at, there'd have to be some factual determination about the intention of having the safety guard? I mean, it strikes me here that your argument is an attractive one where you have bumpers on the outside of a car, but does that mean we then have to have a factual question about what was the intent of this safety guard? Whose safety is it really guarding? Is that necessary then?
Well, Justice Feinstein, I think we already have that to a certain extent. A lot of the cases do look at what was the device intending to do, what was it meant for. So in the Downing case that came out of the 12th District, it was a metal cover over top of a tire shredding machine, and a worker fell in when the cover was removed. And there's a lot of debate over, was the cover there to facilitate the tires entering the machine, or was it there to prevent a worker from falling in? And the court eventually said it had two purposes, and therefore it was an equipment safety guard. So we do have a lot of that. And here, you look at the intent of what this device was for, the bumper guards, and it's solely and exclusively to prevent contact, these carts, industrial carts, from running into workers as they're walking and standing across the tracks, which was very common. I mean, that was, in this plant, you've got these tracks crisscrossing the floor. There's testimony from everyone who was asked, that the workers had to walk across the tracks to perform their job duties. And you've got these bumpers that, on contact, will shut down the machine and no one's hurt.
Was there a factual question then as to whether or not those guards were working, or as the expert testimony that this mechanism had been manipulated so that they weren't working?
Correct. There is, I mean, a lot of that's undisputed, and it's
how can it be undisputed?
Well, what's undisputed is first and foremost that this gentleman's calf muscle was ripped off by the bumper guard. All right, I mean, it was shredded off the bone. And the idea that it was working and just didn't happen to work in that instance, that doesn't make any sense. We know from that fact, the injury itself, that at that moment, the bumper guard was not working. Now, what we also know, and what defense counsel pointed out, is that immediately afterwards, it's inspected and everything's fine. It looks good. There's nothing worn out, nothing broken down. It's working afterwards.
And nothing bypassed.
Nothing bypassed at that point. But what you could see is on this OSHA video that the experts point out, You can see the bumper guard immediately after the accident. There's a film of it. You can see the cart moving down the pathway and the bumper bouncing on the ground in front of it. And the expert points out that each time it bumped, it should have shut down. That should have been enough. And that shows that it had to have been bypassed. That's the only explanation, this human intervention. And that's how it was able to strike this gentleman, roll up over his leg without deactivating.
Mr. Flowers, it strikes me that this case really turns on whether there was enough in to dodge summary. It's still a tough case against the employer because you may have a product liability case against the manufacturer of the machine. It's not an easy case to prove, but the question before us is, was the Court of Appeals right that there was enough shown to dodge summary?
Correct. And these are never easy cases when the employer and management and the co-employees, when they deny that anybody did anything wrong.
Okay, and let's stop with that. Would you agree that if you can't offer persuasive proof that the employer or its employees did something to override the safety device, your client loses?
Correct. They have to deliberately bypass the safety
guard.
Correct.
All right. Correct. So we are talking about a safety device, and to get there under the statute as it's now constituted, you have to, in a trial of this matter, if it got that far, persuade a jury that the employer or the employer's employees intentionally overrode the device.
Deliberately, yes.
Deliberately.
Correct. And in any criminal case where the defendant says, "I didn't do it," the prosecution doesn't throw up their hands and say, "Well, there you go. He says he didn't do it." No, we look at the circumstantial evidence, and then the prosecutor builds their case on circumstantial evidence, and verdicts in favor of the state are upheld under a reasonable doubt standard that are entirely circumstantial. That's what we're doing
so
here.
To get down to where the difference between the two sides is this morning, the employer's counsel is saying doesn't matter if you can prove that we overrode the device, took it out, did something so it wouldn't work. I can't imagine why you would even want to do that. But if you can prove that, you still lose because your client is not covered due to the statute, in his view, saying the safety devices are only there to protect the operator of the machine.
Right. And that is just not supported by the text of the statute. That's not in there. And it produces absurd consequences, which in their reply brief they don't deny. I mean, now we're deciding what a safety guard is based upon the title of the person who is injured, whether they're an operator or non-operator. And you get scenarios like we pointed out where the plant manager is training a young operator as to how to operate a mixing machine, and they're both splashed with a dangerous chemical because a shield has been deliberately removed. The plant operator is not presumed to have been deliberately injured, but the trainee is presumed to be deliberately injured by the removal of the same guard. And that makes no sense.
Well, persuade us that your client offered enough to dodge summary.
Correct. And here, in our circumstantial case, we're following the Sherlock Holmes theory that once you eliminate the impossible, everything that's left, no matter how improbable, is the truth. All right. And here, we know at the moment of injury, the device wasn't working. We know from video that it was seen, car was seen bouncing down the pathway, that it wasn't deactivating. The employer now contends nothing was found amiss. There is no product liability claim. Everything was on the up and up. They have no other explanation. No employee has come forward and said, I fixed it wrong, something like that. They have no expert saying there's an alternate explanation for what happened. The only explanation we have is from our two experts, Mr. Smith and Mr. Rennell, who say that you need human intervention to see that happening in the video, for that man's calf to be stripped off like that. You have to have somebody disabling that device, and the reason you would want to disable that device is because the bumpers are bouncing on the ground, workers have been standing on them.
Well, Mr. Flowers, wait a minute. Isn't there also the possibility, because we are talking about summary judgment, that the device was just malfunctioning? You say you have OSHA video showing that it's going down the road, and when it should have been stopping, it wasn't stopping.
Right. 2 points to that. First, our experts point out that these devices have safety features built in them. They're fail-safe. So that if anything is not functioning, the whole cart shuts down. So there are fail-safe mechanisms in there. Second, they say themselves, there's nothing wrong with these. We checked them every week. We looked at it afterwards. There's no malfunction there, nothing wrong.
Well, you're following, though, Justice Pfeiffer's logic there, though, and unfortunately, here we are at the Supreme Court of Ohio, and we're weighing all these facts.
Correct.
So I guess my real direct question is, why are you here today? And I know you're the appellee, so you're here by invitation. However, however, didn't the Court of Appeals say it was improper to grant summary judgment?
Correct.
Why didn't the matter, therefore, go back to the trial for a trial?
Absolutely. And I think today's argument really has shown that. You know, there's no unique issues of law here. There's nothing that this court needs to go on and decide that wasn't decided in Hewitt. Right? They're just arguing facts. You know, they're arguing how the facts apply to the law.
For example, there's no winners here today.
But Mr.
Right? Yeah. I'd like to be a winner. But
Well, you haven't won, though, because you haven't had your trial. Mm-hmm.
This is true. They've got a trial to present all those factual arguments.
Although, Mr. Flowers, we are talking about this equipment safety guard exception to the intentional tort. So we are talking about development of the law with respect to the new statute and what it means. And the definition of equipment safety guard is not within the statute. So it's cases like this that we have to look at for the future of other cases.
True. And the Hewitt decision, I think, spelled it all out. I mean, Hewitt gives us a definition of equipment safety guard. Hewitt tells us what a deliberate removal requires. The only thing in Hewitt that is being misconstrued here is the reference to the operator, which is plainly dicta. I mean, Mr. Hewitt was a lineman. He worked on electrical lines. I mean, it really wasn't that long ago that we were all here up in Cleveland talking about Mr. Hewitt. But the issue of operator versus non-operator never came up. And that part of this court's decision is actually adopted from Fickle. Fickle's a Sixth Circuit case written by the same Sixth Circuit judge who wrote this one, Judge Yarborough. Right? And he was just commenting that the general understanding of a safety guard is one that protects the operator. But as all the OSHA regulations we've cited attest, there are plenty of safety guards that do more than that. That protect employees who are working with the operator, employees who are training the operator, employees who happen to be walking by as part of their job duties. We gave the example of a fan. You commonly see large industrial fans in plants that are in the walls, and they're required to be guarded. Well, there's no operator for the fan, yet they're required to be guarded so an employee doesn't actually stumble into them or get their clothes caught. Pulleys, gears, exposed rollers, chutes, all of those are required to be guarded. And there's safety guards, even though there's no operator.
But Mr. Flowers, the concern that I have is the evidence regarding deliberate removal. Because the way the statute is created, we're talking about a presumption of an intent to injure the employee. Intent to injure and deliberate removal. What evidence was there in the record of deliberate removal?
Well, the evidence of the record was the circumstantial case we built up because no one admitted to it. And it was the fact that we know at the moment of injury, this wasn't working. We know from the video, the bumper was seen bouncing on the ground as the cart moved. It should have deactivated and wasn't. There's no finding or testimony here that there was a malfunction. It wasn't working, and the only conceivable explanation is that it was human intervention. It was deactivated so that the cart could move even though the bumper was bouncing on the ground. And the bumper was bouncing on the ground because workers were standing on it. Footprints prove that. That's
so,
the circumstantial case.
I haven't seen a picture of this device, but so the bumper extended out some distance, I take it, from the machine itself. And you're saying from time to time, employees caught a ride on the machine by standing on the front or rear bumper.
Right.
And the process of that bent the thing down so that instead of being inches above the floor, it was in near proximity of the floor.
Correct. It was supposed to be 2 inches so that not even someone's foot could get under it without stopping it. But because workers were standing on it, it was bent down and would bounce. And there's welding marks.
When you say were, you don't mean at the time of the accident, you mean workers had previously stood on it from time to time.
Correct. It was
a common
phenomenon.
Is there direct evidence of that? Is there direct evidence of that in the record?
Yes.
That workers, that's why, so it essentially had been removed because workers were stepping on it.
So it could have been a maintenance problem.
Oh, correct. I'm sure it was.
As opposed to deliberate removal.
It was maintenance deliberate removing it because they didn't have any other way to fix the bumpers and the carts remain operable.
Do you have evidence of that?
Well, again, it's our circumstantial case.
I mean, we're talking speculation and hypotheticals, and I understand you're saying there's no other explanation. This is the only explanation that could be there for your circumstantial case. But, I mean, there may be other possibilities as to why it was not functioning at the time.
But if that were true, you'd expect an expert affidavit from the defense, and there is none. They have no expert who is up here saying there is a perfectly benign explanation for what happened.
But that's not their burden.
Well, you get to a point where the plaintiff has a case, they put it on. If there is some explanation, the other side's got to step up. And they haven't done that here. The only person here saying that this thing didn't really take off this guy's calf muscle is defense counsel. He's the only one. There's no other witness who's going to confirm that. So with that, I'd ask you to affirm.
Before you sit down, Mr. Flowers, do you have any cases where a safety guard has been applied to other than an operator? I know you're familiar with the field. I just wonder if your research shows the application to individuals other than operators.
Yeah, the Downard case I talked about.
Which one?
The Downard case out of the 12th District. It's fairly recent. We had a gentleman who fell into this tire shredding machine.
Yes, I remember the one.
Not necessarily an operator, as I recall it. Typically, the operator is the most common injury victim, but the OSHA regulations show that there are other employees who are supposed to be protected as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Denny, you want to take a...
Very briefly, just moment. Summary. First of all, I want to remind the court that we're talking about the rebuttable presumption, as Justice Lanzinger said. Because someone is not an operator doesn't mean they do not have a cause of action under the intentional tort action. They just do not get the benefit of the rebuttable presumption. So if an employee is injured as a result of the deliberate removal of an equipment safety guard, they can proceed under A and B of the section. They don't get the benefit of the presumption. That's the first thing. The second thing is, even assuming the opinions of the experts in this case are correct, let's take them for face value. The experts do not say who bypassed it. They don't say when it was bypassed, why it was bypassed. Again, there is no evidence in this record.
But Mr. Denny, isn't this going back to the trial court?
Pardon me?
Is this matter going back to the trial court?
No. Well, if it does, it'll be in a trial.
You don't know if it's going back.
No. And you know, you raise an important point, if I may. If the Court of Appeals is affirmed here, this employer will be forced to go to trial and rebut a presumption that it intended to injure Mr. Pixley in a case that would never have survived the three-prong test of Fife and Van Fossen, because there's no evidence this employer had knowledge of a dangerous situation, no evidence that this employer had knowledge that that dangerous situation would substantially injure Mr. Pixley, and clearly no evidence that this employer required Mr. Pixley to be where he was when he was injured. So that, I think, sort of summarizes the employer's position as to the Court of Appeals decision resulting in a significant expansion rather than a significant restriction of this type of litigation in the courts of Ohio.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Denny.
Thank you.
Case is submitted, and counsel and the parties will be advised of the outcome after our deliberations and an opinion is written and published. Marshall will give us, adjourn the court for a brief recess, and we will be back. There is one final case left on today's calendar.